Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 20th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is just a little snapshot of the protest out in Los Angeles over the weekend. On the right-hand side, we have three of the California National Guard. They're in their riot gear. They've got the shields up in front of them. And they're standing off against three protesters. They're all brown-skinned. One young man has a baseball cap and wearing a Mexican flag as a cape. He's got his hand on the shoulder of a young lady who's got a bandana around her face. And then another fella on the other side of him who's yelling and got his finger poking the shield of the National Guard guardsman. The headline is, "Show of Force. Has Trump undermined democracy by putting troops on L.A. streets?" That is our first main story, and we will start with that. Trump sends National Guard Marines into L.A. What happened? California Governor Gavin Newsom warned this week that democracy is under assault after President Trump sent 4,000 National Guardsmen and 700 Marines to Los Angeles to quell anti-ICE protests, and described the deployment as a preview of what he'd do in other cities if unrest spread. The demonstrations erupted late last week after federal agents arrested undocumented migrant workers in L.A.'s Fashion District, a Home Depot parking lot, and several other locations across the city. Protests that began downtown outside a federal detention center soon spread to heavily Latino areas in Compton and the suburb of Paramount, where demonstrators shouted anti-ICE slogans while waving Mexican flags. Some threw bottles, rocks, and Molotov cocktails at police and torched self-driving Waymo taxis. Police dispersed the crowds with pepper spray, flash bangs, and tear gas, and arrested hundreds. Newsom and Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass insisted city police could manage the unrest, but Trump sent 2,000 California National Guard members to the city, then deployed 2,000 more and 700 Marines, even as he allowed the situation was very well under control. Newsom sued to block the troops being used as law enforcement. Photos show guardsmen accompanying ICE agents as they made arrests, calling it a brazen abuse of power. It's rare for a president to deploy the National Guard over a governor's objections. Trump claimed the power under a law allowing the president to quell a rebellion against the federal government. Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, threatened to arrest Bass and Newsom if they interfered with immigration enforcement. "I'd do it if I were Tom," said Trump. In a televised address, Newsom said Trump's rhetoric and use of the military had put the nation on the brink of authoritarianism. "Other states are next," he said. "Democracy is next." Trump and aides repeatedly called the protesters insurrectionist, possibly laying the groundwork for invoking the 1807 Insurrection Act, which gives the president power to use the military to quell domestic unrest. Trump said he would certainly invoke it if needed, while aide Stephen Miller said the administration was engaged in a fight to save civilization as anti-ICE demonstrations spread to San Francisco, Austin, Dallas, Chicago, and New York. Trump warned that protesters would face equal or greater force than L.A. has. "We're going to have troops everywhere." What the editorial said: Trump's troop call-up marks a dangerous escalation in his testing of the limits of presidential power, said the Albany Times-Union. "It has nothing to do with maintaining law and order, and he and his allies, as he and his allies claim, Instead, it's an authoritarian show of force and a blatant attack on Americans' First Amendment rights. Calling a largely peaceful protest a rebellion would be laughable if it weren't so dangerous. Activating the National Guard without gubernatorial approval is highly unusual, said National Review. It hasn't been done since President Lyndon B. Johnson sent guardsmen to Alabama to protect civil rights marchers in 1965. But Trump's deployment is justified. Attacking federal agents is no small matter. And rioters have looted stores, destroyed property, and pelted police with chunks of concrete. As we learned during the 2020 George Floyd uprising, urban riots can quickly spiral out of control if there isn't an overwhelming show of force early. What the columnist said. Trump was spoiling for this fight, said Ronald Brownstein in Bloomberg, and he has done all he can to escalate it. The administration carried out the migrant raids in a highly public way, certain to draw protest, then sent in the Guard without even a pretense of coordinating with Newsom. It shows Trump's confidence that his migrant crackdown is a winning issue politically and laid bare his hunger for confrontation with blue states and cities. To Trump, they're not partners, but hostile territory to be subdued. Progressives like Newsom brought this on themselves, said Nicole Russell in USA Today. They thumbed their noses at immigration laws, refused to cooperate with federal immigration authorities, and sent a clear message to people all over the world that the border was open. Now, as Trump tries to restore order, local Democrats are making excuses for protesters who've obstructed federal agents and turned Los Angeles into a war zone. It's up to Trump to enforce the law, whether they like it or not. This isn't about quelling violence, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. The right's claim that L.A. is out of control is pure fantasy. Violence occurred in only a few neighborhoods, and Bass quickly imposed a curfew downtown. Just as ludicrous are claims by Miller and others that the Mexican flags flown by a few protesters are proof L.A. is occupied territory. The administration's real goal is to intimidate those who might take part in civil disobedience and protest against our rapid descent into authoritarianism. Los Angeles may quiet down, but it's a preview of coming attractions, said William Crystal in the Bulwark. Why did Trump send 700 Marines on the backs of 4,000 National Guard members? It fits the performative needs of our childish commander-in-chief. But there's more going on here. By deploying active-duty military to a U.S. city, Trump has breached another red line. And if he gets away with it, he'll have normalized the practice for Americans and made it much easier to do so again in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Whether public will stand up against the usurpation remains to be seen, but the Rubicon has been crossed. Controversy of the week. Abrego Garcia. Why the White House blinked. Finally, a win for the rule of law, said the New York Daily News in an editorial. Attorney General Pam Bondi announced last week that Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father of three who was shipped to a prison in his native El Salvador in March, is now back on U.S. soil. The undocumented migrant's deportation was clearly illegal. A 2019 court order barred his removal to El Salvador due to fear of persecution. But for 3 months, the Trump administration defied judicial orders to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return, including one from the Supreme Court, coyly claiming the U.S. was powerless to interfere in El Salvador's custodial system. It eventually backed down amid warnings of a constitutional crisis. But this being the Trump administration, Abrego Garcia, 29, is not a free man. Instead, he is suddenly facing multiple federal charges over allegations that he unlawfully transported thousands of undocumented aliens across the U.S. as a member of the street gang MS-13. Whether the indictment is solid or not, Abrego Garcia will now have competent legal defense and will be before independent judges. He will have all the protections that are due to him under the Constitution, protections he lost during his disappearance to El Salvador. This is not the homecoming Abrego Garcia hoped for, said Jonathan Turley in FoxNews.com. If convicted on these serious charges, which include accusations that he smuggled guns and narcotics, he will face life in prison. As for the administration, it's ended this controversy on its own terms, neither defying the courts nor conceding limits on its power to deport. Democrats, meanwhile, have committed a historic political blunder, said Peter Laffin in the Washington Examiner. They spent months insisting Abrego Garcia was a model citizen swept up in Trump's supposedly racist deportation scheme. But during his trial, prosecutors will detail his alleged trafficking of women and children and how his wife repeatedly accused him of domestic violence. Each hideous new detail will remind voters of his beatification by the party of open borders. That assumes the government is telling the truth about Abrego Garcia, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate, and there are reasons to be skeptical. If prosecutors had proof of criminal wrongdoing, why didn't they reveal it back in March and spare themselves months of scandal? More to the point, why wasn't he arrested in 2022? Most of the trafficking charges in the indictment stem from an incident that year in Tennessee, when cops found Abrego Garcia driving in an SUV with nine male Hispanic passengers. Abrego Garcia said he was headed to a construction site. He wasn't detained that day, let alone charged, and Bondi will have to explain what's changed since then, other than Trump's election, and his suddenly urgent desire to find a justification for his blatantly unlawful rendition program. Some Democrats did go overboard trying to portray Abrego Garcia as sympathetic, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. But this story was never about a particular migrant's character. It's about whether the president can send people from U.S. soil to foreign prisons and hold them there even when courts say it is illegal. That question remains terrifyingly unresolved, said Ilya Somin in Reason. Abrego Garcia's return proves the administration is not yet entirely resistant to judicial and public pressure. But Trump has deported hundreds of other migrants without due process. It's now up to the courts and the rest of us to push for their return and ensure that such a thing can never happen again. And it's time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for free assembly. After a federal appeals court ruled that San Diego's ban on yoga classes in city parks and beaches was unconstitutional, I personally see this as a triumph of community over a handful of elites, said yoga fan John Nowak, who blamed the now overturned ban on the influence of wealthy beachfront property owners. It was a good week for sob stories. After physicists at Britain's Loughborough University created the world's smallest violin, the instrument etched from platinum using nanolithography is 13 microns wide. That's thinner than a human hair, which can measure up to 180 microns in diameter. It was a good week for loopholes after New Mexico prosecutors dropped charges against a 16-year-old baseball player who admitted to urinating in an opposing team's water jug during a game. While the act is gross and not right, said Chief Deputy D.A. Jessica Martinez, it's not a crime in New Mexico. It was a bad week for the Fourth Estate after Sovereignty beat Journalism to win the 157th Belmont Stakes. The decisive three-length victory, a near carbon copy of Sovereignty's win in last month's Kentucky Derby, has sparked talk that Journalism's best days may be behind him. It was a bad week for go-getters after Osmir Djokovic, 19, was arrested for driving a Mercedes E300 at 132 miles per hour on I-91 in Connecticut. Djokovic, who led police on a high-speed chase, ignoring their lights and sirens, told officers that he didn't stop because he was late for a job interview. Finally, it was a bad week for the 19th hole. After health inspectors slapped President Trump's Bedminster, New Jersey golf club with 18 health code violations, 9 of them considered critical. Food at the club is not sufficiently well protected from contamination, the inspectors found, and food contact surfaces are not properly cleaned and sanitized. And a short in other news on this same page. Supreme Court grants DOJ access to Social Security data. The Supreme Court ruled last week that members of the Department of Government Efficiency can access data collected by the Social Security Administration, including the Social Security numbers, medical records, and banking information of millions of Americans. In a 6-3 decision, the conservative majority granted an emergency application by the Trump administration to lift an injunction issued by a federal judge in Maryland. DOJ has said that access to that information will help it modernize systems and eliminate waste and fraud at the agency. In a dissenting opinion, Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson criticized the majority for granting DOJ unfettered access to sensitive data before the courts have time to assess whether DOJ's access is lawful. In a separate 6-3 order, the Supreme Court shielded DOJ from Freedom of Information Act request while litigation over its activities continues. Time for the briefing. Title this week, Qatar's Power Play. The tiny Arab nation is buying friends and influence in Washington. What does it want? What is Qatar doing in the U.S.? It's showering money and gifts on key political players. Last month, presenting President Trump with a $400 million luxury Boeing 747 that could eventually serve as Air Force One. Trump's acceptance of the jet grew criticism from even staunch MAGA allies. Far-right influencer Laura Loomer called it a gift from jihadists in suits, alluding to Qatar's extensive ties to Islamist groups across the Middle East. That 747 was just the most public display of a years-long push by ultra-wealthy Qatar. The Connecticut-sized nation is the world's third-largest exporter of liquefied natural gas, to curry favor with both Republicans and Democrats. Since 2017, the Emirate has spent some $225 million on lobbying and public relations efforts in Washington. Some of that cash flowed to Mercury Public Affairs when it was led by Susie Wiles, now Trump's chief of staff, and to FBI Director Kash Patel, a former consultant for Qatar. Attorney General Pam Bondi, who signed off on the 747 gift as legal, used to work for a lobbying firm that earned $115,000 a month from Qatar. And New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez, former chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was found guilty in January of taking bribes under the expectation he'd use his influence and power to benefit the government of Qatar. But the Arab nation's spending spree isn't solely focused on politicians. Where else is its money going? To American colleges and universities, which have received at least $6.3 billion from Qatar since the U.S. government started tracking such data in 1986. That's about $700 million more than China, the second largest source of foreign funding for U.S. schools. Much of the money has gone to universities such as Georgetown and Cornell, which have opened satellite campuses in the Qatari capital, Doha. Qatar's media-savvy ruling Al Thani family, which founded the globally influential Al Jazeera network, has also invested in American news outlets. One royal, Sheikh Sultan bin Jasmine Al Thani, pumped $50 million into the pro-Trump Newsmax channel in 2019 and 2020. Around that time, Newsmax execs reportedly pushed staff to avoid covering Qatar's shaky human rights record or its brutal treatment of migrant laborers in the run-up to the 2022 World Cup. "We were told very clearly from the top down, no touching this," said one employee. Earlier this year, a consulting firm paid $180,000 monthly by Qatar helped facilitate a friendly interview between Qatari Prime Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani and conservative commentator Tucker Carlson. What does Qatar hope to achieve? The country may be trying to temper criticism of its foreign policy, notably its support for Islamist groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood, various jihadist factions in Libya and Syria, and above all, Hamas. Qatar sent at least $2 billion to the Palestinian terrorist group in recent years, according to a report by lawyers for the families of people killed in Hamas October 7, 2023, attack on Israel. And until last year, key Hamas leaders were allowed to live in Doha. Why would you welcome into your country these forces that could be potentially destabilizing? Asked Stephen Cook, a Middle East expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. I think, well, maybe they are true believers. Education Secretary Linda McMahon in April accused Qatar of orchestrating a financial infiltration of U.S. colleges to reshape how our elite campuses teach about Israel and the Middle East. A week later, McMahon sat down for what she described as a productive conversation with Qatar's ambassador to the U.S. While some see Qatar as being motivated by extremism, others see its foreign policy as being driven by more pragmatic concerns. What are those? Qatar is phenomenally wealthy. Its $526 billion sovereign wealth fund is the world's eighth largest, but it remains a tiny, vulnerable nation in a volatile neighborhood. Home to some 3 million people, only 300,000 of whom are native Qataris, the country shares a land border with one regional hegemon, Saudi Arabia, and sits across the Persian Gulf from another one, Iran. Following Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait, another small, hydrocarbon-rich state, the Al Thani family decided their best bet for security lay in making their diminutive country a major player in world affairs, economically, politically, and culturally. Qatar ramped up natural gas exports to Europe and Japan and bolstered its security ties with the U.S. by spending $1 billion to build Al Udeid Air Base. That base, outside Doha, is now the largest U.S. military installment in the Middle East and the forward headquarters for the U.S. Central Command. Qatar also boosted funding and support for Islamist groups across the Muslim world to help the petrostate avoid losing public support in its own region, said Alan Fromhertz, a historian specializing in the Middle East. Has the strategy worked? Qatar's policy of playing both sides caused a crisis in 2017 when President Trump threw his support behind a blockade of Doha by Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Bahrain. Those countries demanded Qatar end its support of Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated Islamist groups that grew in popularity during the Arab Spring and were now threatening their regimes. Trump reversed his stance on the blockade the following year, but it gave the Al-Thanis a taste of what life might be like without American support. Spooked, the Qataris kept a close connection with Trump world when he left office in 2021 and bolstered their charm offensive when he returned to the White House in January. For now, the president seems delighted with the Qataris' generosity. While visiting Doha last month, Trump thanked his hosts for their unbelievable splendor and warmth and described Qatar as a key diplomatic force on the world stage. And we'll read a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Hey, don't deport people I know. When immigration officials arrested and imprisoned beloved local waitress Carol Hui in April, said Jonathan V. Last, her neighbors in Kennett, Missouri, were outraged. Donning Bring Carol Home t-shirts, they rallied around the hardworking mom of three, who delighted Waffle House customers since arriving in the U.S. from Hong Kong 20 years ago. Hui was released last week, pending further hearings. But this isn't some heartwarming story about the strength of small-town bonds. It's an indictment of the worst people in America. More than 80% of people in Dunklin County, where Kennett is located, voted for Donald Trump, who vowed to deport 20 million immigrants. These voters are culpable for Carol's imprisonment, but somehow are blind to their complicity. They also seem oblivious to the reality that Trump's henchmen are now seizing thousands of hardworking immigrants from restaurants, stores, construction sites, and farm fields. Do they think Carol is the only good person being deported? Do only people you know matter? One of Carol's friends said she's a fan of almost everything Trump has done, except that he's tore her friend's life and family apart. Mindless voters like her have set the country ablaze. The Epstein files backfire on MAGA. When Elon Musk last week accused the Trump administration of hiding parts of the Epstein files to protect the president, another MAGA conspiracy theory backfired, said Glenn Thrush. Attorney General Pam Bondi and the partisan showman running the FBI, Director Kash Patel and Deputy Dan Bongino, have championed the conspiracy theories, such as that accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein was killed in jail to conceal his ties to powerful people. Democrats, they hoped, but not Trump. Having promised the MAGA base they would reveal deep state secrets, these Trump law enforcers now find themselves in a trap of their own making, as the true believers demand results. Witness Bongino's glum recent admission that he's concluded Epstein killed himself in jail, just as the FBI said. He and Patel have promised breakthroughs in cases that have gripped the president's base, including the discovery of some cocaine in the West Wing during the Biden administration, the 2022 leak of the draft Supreme Court opinion overturning abortion rights, and the claim that the FBI fomented the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Having raised expectations of spectacular arrest, Bongino and Patel are running a conspiracy theory fulfillment center with unstocked shelves. This column comes from the UK. Hands that can do little but swipe. Britons are becoming like clutch-phobic Americans, unable to drive stick, said Libby Purvis. Just one in five new cars sold here has a manual transmission. The trend was probably inevitable given the rise of EVs, and maybe the soothing quality of leaving decisions to a robot suits fretful souls. Yet I cleave to my gear stick. There is something masterful and deliberate about downshifting on a curve or popping into high gear on a straightaway. The smooth growl focuses you, reminding you that despite this age of button pushing and screen swiping, you are not playing video games, but in personal control of a big, heavy, dangerous machine. Most of us, even older workers, no longer do much requiring manual dexterity, while the younger generations have never had to master even easing a gear lever to reverse. That has real consequences. Changes like this reduce the palpable necessity for coordination and let relevant brain cells atrophy. Already, medical schools are complaining that young would-be surgeons have spent so much time staring at screens, they need hours of remedial sewing lessons simply to manage a basic suture. The result of all this is that we are losing touch with what makes us human. We are animals, after all, and need to be made to feel it daily. Now for the last word, our feature article. Disappearing Act. For a substantial price, privacy consultants will help you vanish, said Benjamin Wallace in The Atlantic. But staying invisible when you buy a car or log on to Netflix is a challenge. You could easily mistake Alec Harris for a spy or an escaped prisoner, given all of the tradecraft he devotes to being unfindable. Mail addressed to him goes to a UPS store. To buy things online, he uses a Yubi key, a small piece of hardware resembling a thumb drive, to open Bitwarden, a password manager that stores his hundreds of unique long random passwords. Then he logs into privacy.com, a subscription service that lets him open virtual debit cards under as many different names as he wishes. Harris has 191 cards at this point, each specific to a single vendor, but all linked to the same bank account. This isolates risk. If any vendor is breached, whatever information it has about him won't be exploitable anywhere else. Harris has likewise strictly limited access to his work and personal phone numbers by associating his main phone with up to 10 different numbers. He has burner numbers and project-specific numbers, a local area code number to give out to workers coming to his house, a dedicated number for two-factor authentication, and a number from a city where he previously lived that he doesn't use much anymore but is helpful for ambiguating his identity in databases. He has additional numbers that, through a fancy hardware modification, even his mobile carriers can't associate with his device. In a safe at home, Harris keeps prepaid anonymous debit and gift cards, Google Play, Apple Gift, prepaid SIM cards, phones for use in Europe, a Faraday bag to shield wireless devices from hacks and location tracking, a burner laptop, and family passports. He also carries a passport card, a wallet-sized government-issued ID that, unlike a driver's license, doesn't show his address. For food deliveries, he might give a random neighbor's address and, after the order is accepted, message the driver, "Oops, I typed out the address wrong. Let me know when you're here and I'll run out." Harris is the CEO of Haven X, a firm that provides its clients with extreme privacy and security services. It was spun off from Halo, which focuses on government clients, in 2023. Haven X customers, some of whom pay tens of thousands of dollars a month, typically face serious threats. Some are celebrities or ultra-wealthy families. Others are business executives. Interest from this group has risen since the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson last year. Many Haven X clients come from the cryptocurrency world. Some made a fast fortune, and because they can't park their crypto in a bank, are unusually vulnerable. Harris lives with his wife, Ellen, a psychotherapist, and their two sons on an affluent edge of Washington, D.C., in a grayish clapboard house tucked away on a street that doesn't get much traffic. When I visited earlier this year, snow covered the front yard, and a braided rope bone and a red Kong chew toy were half visible. A tall, fit 43-year-old, Harris answered the door with a welcoming smile. I found the house only because he told me the address in advance. When I'd looked up his name on a paid database, I'd seen other addresses for him, but not this one. After Harris gave me his address, I searched for it and found only the name of a trust. Also, Harris doesn't have a dog. The toys out front were for show, a subtler version of a fake home security system sign. From a cabinet in his office, Harris pulled a sheaf of legal documents and began to show me how he managed his double life. Achieving residential anonymity had been a process. When he bought the house, he'd set up the trust using a close friend as the trustee. Once the home purchase was complete, the friend resigned and named Harris as his successor. Mail sent here, including nearly daily Amazon deliveries, is addressed to either the trust or some other name. Whether a random pseudonym Harris used when filling out a form, or something generic like postal customer. He showed me a holiday card he'd received at the house the day before, and a text exchange from that morning with a friend who'd sent it. "Thanks so much, love the pic on the back," he had written. "Small favor, our address is unlisted, so would you mind using this for mail?" Harris had typed the address for the UPS store. "Anything with our name on it goes there." At least one such holiday card misdirection occurs every year. "This is a super nice family, and I want them in our lives, and so I want to be nice about it," Harris told me. As we sat there, a text came in from the friend, affirming that from now on, he'd use the other address. Over the past two decades, we surrendered our privacy in return for conveniences such as free email, supercomputers in our pockets, same-day package delivery, and the names of third and fourth cousins we'd never heard of before. We now inhabit a panopticon of doorbell cameras and traffic cameras and Google Street View cameras and police body cameras and phone cameras and retail security cameras and the cameras of Mark Zuckerberg's Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses, of geolocating phones and AirTags, of eavesdropping Siris and Alexas. Most of us, ignorant, indifferent, overwhelmed, shrug. Others, including Harris and his clients, have taken more radical steps. And they have done so by drawing, knowingly or not, from the tradecraft of a former cop named Michael Bazell. It was from Bazell that Harris learned how to set up his trust and got the ideas for the passport card and the dog toys. On a bookshelf in his home office, alongside Jaron Lanier's You Are Not a Gadget, is Bazell's exhaustive guide to this dark 21st century art. Extreme privacy, what it takes to disappear. Bazell had his own awakening in 2001 as an Illinois beat cop turned cybercrime detective. His work had led to the arrest of a local elections official for soliciting sex from a 14-year-old girl. amid the ensuing media coverage of that and similar arrest. Internet anons made death threats against Bazell, and he was shocked to learn how easy it was to find his home address online. Soon after, browsing at the library, he discovered How to Be Invisible, a book by a missionary named J.J. Luna, assigned to the Canary Islands in the 1960s when Spain's Franco government was persecuting Protestants. Luna was forced to live undercover. When he returned to the U.S. in 1988, he decided to maintain his private lifestyle and publish a book showing others how they might do the same, using LLCs, ghost addresses, and other tricks. Bazell resolved to execute all of the practices Luna recommended. Over time, students surpassed teacher. Bazell pioneered or updated many of their privacy hacks, now taken as standard. To obtain an ID without betraying one's location, Bazell recommended establishing residency in South Dakota, which is distinctly friendly to year-round RVers and other nomads. For sending mail without divulging your address, Bazell preferred a private remailer service also based in South Dakota. Though he catered to people in dire situations, Bazell also experimented on himself. To ensure that his cell phone was never associated with his address, he kept it off and in a Faraday bag until he arrived at a four-way intersection some distance from his home. Mindful of the increasing prevalence of police cars, tow trucks, and other vehicles carrying automated license plate readers, he used magnetic license plate holders and removed his plates whenever he was parked somewhere overnight. Foregoing cloud storage, he backed up his data on a flash memory card the size of a fingernail, concealed the card in a hollow nickel, and then, while in the bathroom at a friend's house, unscrewed an electrical plate and hid the coin behind it. When he later needed to access the backup, he had to call the friend and reveal what he'd done. To throw off gate recognition systems, which have popped up in Beijing and Shanghai, among other places, he tried wearing two sizes of the same shoe. There's a cost to living this way. You must consider everything from your car's registration to your house's utility hookups, and the measures required to prevent a misstep can be comically elaborate. Buying a car presents special difficulties. Harris followed a detailed script laid out by Bazell, calling a dealer to say he wanted to come for a test drive, then canceling at the last minute, then calling again when he was outside the dealership and trying to fast-talk a salesman into foregoing the usual ID check. They looked at him. They were like, "Yeah, you're not getting in the car without scanning your driver's license," Harris said. The rudiments of daily life can also be cumbersome. Harris recalled setting up a new TV with Disney Plus and having to undo some auto-filled information and replace it with his abstruse Anon-Addy email address, then typing out one of his extra-long passwords, only to get a character wrong and have to start over. All while his young children became antsy. And so then you've got two kids sitting there, and they're like, "I want Domino's, and I want to watch Mulan," Harris laughed. "That's the price you pay." "What do you think of our life?" Ellen Harris asked me. She smiled warmly. "Do you think we're so weird?" Alex's wife, between Zoom appointments, had joined us, and we were talking about raising a family inside a privacy cone. Alex had eased Ellen into privacy practices, starting with the Bitwarden password manager. "I remember sitting with him on our couch in D.C. in our old condo," she said, "being like, 'This seems really hard. I don't know if I want to do this. I just want everything to be the same word with the same numbers. And I used an exclamation point at the end, so that makes me unique. No one will ever find out. And I capitalized the first letter, so we're fine." She laughed the wry laugh of a privacy vet making fun of her younger self. But then Alec got her some hidden phone numbers. I didn't even think about that, she recalled. That was just a way to sneak privacy into my life. Now living privately no longer feels like such a big deal, and she's come to appreciate the emotional security that goes with it. She was wildly supportive, Alec interjected. You do just get used to it, Ellen said. Using tools that at first seem unwieldy, like a password locker, comes to feel easier than not using them. I wondered, given her work in mental health, whether she thought Alec ever edged into paranoia. There's this idea in psychology called a learned phobia, she said, where, for example, if you observe someone who has a fear of flying often enough, you could actually absorb that fear and that become yours. So Alec's paranoia has become mine, so that means we'd both be worthy of diagnosis. We could be in the same mental institution, Alec said. I mean, that's the dream, right? Ellen said. With workers who came to the house, Ellen started using just her middle name, Leslie. But one time James, the older of their elementary school age son, says, That's not your name. Oh my God, James, don't blow my cover, she said, before explaining to the workman that it was her middle name. But she was clearly not quite as committed as Alec. Whenever a visitor nervously asked where the dog was, Alec would say it wasn't home at the moment. Oh, Ellen would say, laughing, I'm just like, we don't really have a dog. Ellen still frets when arranging play dates. She's trying to make mom friends, but if a mother asks for her address, she's gotten used to sending a pin drop. When one mom put the Harris's address in her contacts, Ellen found herself saying, I'm so sorry, but could you not do that? And that's weird. But the thing is, I just tell them that Alec works in privacy, and because they live in the D.C. metro area, she went on, people kind of get it. Both Alec and Ellen are personable, and Alec felt this was also important to the success of their privacy. I would say, other than in this area, we're not very weird, he said. If we were eccentric in all areas of our lives, it would be harder to pull off. A longer version of this article originally appeared in The Atlantic. And we may have time for two of the Talking Points articles today. Let's start with discrimination, expanding the definition. Reverse discrimination lawsuits will now be easier to bring, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. The Supreme Court last week ruled unanimously in favor of a woman who argued she was discriminated against for being straight. In Ames versus Ohio, Marlene Ames claimed her gay boss at the Ohio Department of Youth Services promoted a lesbian with less experience over her. She was later demoted and replaced by a gay man with less seniority. Ames argued these actions constituted discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. But an appeals court said that as a member of a majority group, straight people, she faced a higher standard to prove her claim. The Supreme Court disagreed. Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, the court's first black female justice, explained in the opinion that the law doesn't vary based on the identity of the person alleging discrimination. The ruling might seem like a win for conservatives, but by affirming that all forms of bias violate Title VII, it's a victory for the rule of law. Actually, the ruling makes it clear there is no such thing as reverse discrimination, says Charles C.W. Cook in National Review. Liberals think only members of the majority can be racist or bigoted, insisting that whites and heterosexuals are so privileged they can't suffer discrimination. But Title VII doesn't prohibit discrimination in a particular direction. It simply prohibits discrimination, irrespective of which immutable characteristics an individual exhibits. DEI is almost universally loathed by normal people, And the court just caught up to public opinion. This decision was correct in theory, said Ellie Mistel in The Nation, but it clears the way for a flood of reverse discrimination lawsuits. Emboldened by President Trump, white people are blaming anti-white discrimination every time a non-white person is hired or promoted. This ruling is like hanging an open for grievances sign on every federal courthouse. But the clarified standard does not make it easier for white or straight plaintiffs to win discrimination claims, said Robin Nicole Sanders in Slate. It merely establishes the same standard for illegal discrimination against any person on the basis of race, sexual orientation, or other protected traits. It's tempting to see every ruling through the lens of gain or loss, progressive or conservative, but we shouldn't let our fears of bad faith obscure a rare moment of doctrinal clarity. Travel ban. It's back, and it's bigger. Welcome to the gratuitously cruel sequel to one of Donald Trump's most infamous first-term policies, said Mustafa Bayoumi in The Guardian. In an expanded repeat of the January 2017 Muslim ban, the president last week ordered a ban on arrivals from 12 mainly poor, majority non-white countries, and severe restrictions on seven more. Trump cited security concerns, including the recent terror attack in Boulder, but the alleged attacker was from Egypt, which was not on the list. Trump explained that it's a country we deal with very closely. The contradictions don't end there. The order also cited the problem of foreigners overstaying their visas. Yet Spain, the source of more than 20,000 overstays in 2023, had more than all seven banned African countries combined, but remains exempt. The ban includes key cutouts for current green card holders and visa holders, among others. But make no mistake, this order is designed to keep America as white and Western European as possible. It will also cost lives, said Francis Robles in the New York Times. The ban includes no medical exceptions, meaning more than 300 Haitians on waiting lists for major surgeries in the U.S. are now barred from entering. Patients such as 6-year-old Brad Mertens Joseph, scheduled for a stateside operation to repair a hole in his heart, have had a lifeline abruptly cut. This second-term ban will be harder to fight in court, said Mariah Timms and Michelle Hackman in the Wall Street Journal. The 2017 ban came after Trump's promise of a total and complete shutdown of Muslim immigration, providing clear evidence of racial and religious bias. But subsequent changes, including adding Venezuela and North Korea to the list, led the Trump administration secure a 5-4 Supreme Court victory in 2018, which gave the president wide latitude to bar foreigners he deems detrimental to U.S. interest. Trump's new version, reinstated after President Biden's repeal, seems carefully crafted to meet that standard. When Trump announced the 2017 ban, massive protests erupted at major airports, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. But the current administration has so thoroughly flooded the zone with legally dubious anti-immigrant measures, including shipping migrants to foreign gulags without due process, that this news barely caused a stir. It's a sign of how Trumpism has been a kind of authoritarian autoimmune disease that's just wearing America down. And we'll read some of the shorter notes. Lawmakers in more than a dozen states have introduced or passed legislation aimed at supposed chemtrails being left behind by airplanes. According to a debunked conspiracy theory, the white lines contain chemicals that are spread for population and weather control. In fact, the contrails are primarily composed of water vapor from engine exhaust. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee has signed a law banning the intentional release of airborne chemicals to modify the climate. Similar bills have passed legislatures in Florida and Louisiana. The Department of Homeland Security's main hub for terrorism prevention is now led by a 22-year-old former Trump campaign worker with no apparent national security experience. Thomas Fugate, head of the Center for Prevention Programs and Partnerships, graduated from college last year and worked in a grocery store as recently as August 2023. Since the start of the 2024 election campaign, President Trump has more than doubled his personal wealth to about $5.4 billion through real estate projects, sales from his crypto ventures, and other deals. On the poll watch, 66% of Americans believe birth sex should be required on IDs. 69% say transgender athletes should compete only on teams that match their birth gender. 60% of adults think expanding wind and solar should take priority over fossil fuels, a 19-point drop from 2020. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from French philosopher Jean de La Bruyère, who says, "Those who make the worst use of their time are the first to complain of its brevity." And with that, we're out of time. Sorry, couldn't resist. We're out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.